Hello, and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 43 for March 30th, 2010. I'll be your host this week. My name is David Liu. With me today are
Dominic Rabier,
Ben Snitkoff,
and David O'Brien.
So, we've got three stories for you today. Top on the billing is the new ACTA leak. Some terms have been released of the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, and we'll be taking a look at that. Second up, we have Google's new actions within China and their essential stopping of the censorship policies that China had wanted them to keep in place. And third, we have a story regarding Facebook and a grease monkey script that helps get rid of useless content on Facebook. So, recently there was a leak of the most of the document for the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. So this is a agreement that's being worked on by a number of different countries, including the European Union, the United States, Australia, Canada, Japan, Mexico, and a number of other countries. And as the title suggests, you might think that it would deal mainly with anti-counterfeiting of actual material goods, but the large thrust of this actually has to do with copyrighted works on the internet. And so this is really a large-scale agreement that's being developed for regulating intellectual property. So one of you guys want to walk us through the main points of what's being discussed here?
Well, sure. This agreement has we've talked about it a number of times on the show, and as you suggested, it's been sort of built under this guise of being an anti-counterfeiting agreement. And this is a type of international trade agreement that involves several different countries. And one of the things that we focused on in the past is that the discussions that go on between the countries, and this is just a proposed act at this point. It has not been ratified by any other countries or any of the U.S. Bodies of the legislature, but at present it's been being negotiated through a series of rounds, and all of the discussions have gone on in secrecy. So we know very little about it up to this point. Even as of today, we really don't know exactly what we don't know, if you will, because all the information that we have gotten is through these leaks, which have come out and been posted to the internet. And this week we have seen probably what is being described as the most comprehensive leak as to date regarding what is actually within ACTA. And it raises a significant number of concerns, in particular with how it deals with non-material goods, or sort of the types of things you might think of that fall under intellectual property, digital transmissions and communications between people across the internet, basically all that digital stuff seems to fall underneath what is now within the terms of this agreement. But again, we don't know what we don't know, because we don't know the accuracy of this leak. We don't know to what extent it's actually what the finalized edition, which will eventually have to be approved by the countries. We don't know what that's going to look like, and we don't really know what's going on the U.S. side of things, which is the other big disturbing point here. We don't know what the people who are participating in the negotiation on behalf of the U.S. have said, and what they see as problems, and what they would like to have included in the agreement. We do have a number of statements that were released to the public by some of those trade representatives from the U.S., and up to this point, they have stated that this agreement will not affect the current state of U.S. law. But after this latest leak, it appears that might not necessarily be true, and there are some additional concerns about how exactly we are going to ratify this agreement. There are some particulars under U.S. law in the way that you go about either finalizing a treaty, or whether it is actually an executive order. That mostly has to do with whether or not there is just Senate approval, or whether there is a congressional approval, or if it's an executive order, which is it seems to be how this is going to be currently billed. It would just be a authorized by the president, and it would never go before Congress whatsoever. So those are sort of that's the broad overview of what is going on with this. We can talk a little bit more about what the act includes. There aren't very many changes as far as I've read. of what we've talked about in the past, but the big points are is that the negotiators under this seem to want to have some sort of three strikes law where if a user is, it doesn't necessarily say convicted, but if a user is either accused of infringing copyrighted material or other types of intellectual property rights, they might have their internet access shut off by ISPs, and there are some additional points of criminality. You know, if a person is infringing intellectual property, there might be some criminal consequences to it. And finally, there's some additional points regarding third-party liability, but that's something that we don't currently recognize, at least not fully here in the U.S., but within this agreement, it seems that some of the ISPs, for instance, might have some sort of imputed liability for other people infringing intellectual property rights, at least on the internet or through digital communication services.
Yeah, so let's take a look at some of those stickier points that some people are objecting to. Starting with this whole idea of maybe the introduction of a three strikes law and then the termination of particular users' internet access from the ISPs. I mean, I don't really have a feel for this. It seems like, yeah, okay, a corporation can end its service to an individual for whatever reason, but is there a bigger legal question about shutting someone off from the internet?
Courts in the United States have been pretty free and loose, especially in criminal proceedings, about shutting people off from the internet. There was, and I'm blanking on his name right now, a fairly famous hacker who was, as part of his sentence, banned from using the internet for, I think it was 10 or 15 years. And regularly as a part of a punishment for various internet-related... Kevin Mitnick? Is that right?
Mitnick.
Mitnick. Kevin Mitnick, yeah. So even as part of a punishment for other computer-related crimes... him too?
Yeah, him too.
As I was saying, as punishment for other internet-related crimes, be it, you know, hacking or, I hate to bring this up as an example, but distribution of child pornography, people are very regularly banned from using the internet either permanently or for a certain amount of time. So, at least from a criminal standpoint, I don't think there would be big problems given precedent. That being said, I would be reluctant as a judge to ban anyone from the internet entirely, especially when they're, you know, they'd simply run the risk of, if they reoffend, they'll get caught again. Banning somebody from the internet cuts off so many different avenues of speech. It cuts out avenues of commerce for people. It would be very difficult for somebody specifically of our generation to be cut off entirely from the internet.
The other big point about this is that there isn't really any positive law, meaning there's nothing in the U.S. code to date which really would force an ISP to shut somebody down from internet access. So if you have Comcast and you have a user who is repeatedly uploading infringing content to, you know, some other source, and if there is a judgment that comes out of that, a civil judgment, say like one of the major copyright holders, you know, brings an action against him and wins, there's not really anything in the code which is going to force the ISP to cut off his access. But under the guise of the ACTA language, that would basically require, in some instances, if not at least just pressure those ISPs to shut people down. And so that's probably the biggest point here, is that there isn't anything right now which would force an ISP to do that, but there are some circumstances under which, if ACTA gets passed and ratified in the U.S. and we become a party to the agreement, that you could have some problems with ISPs if it's just civil liability, whereby, you know, those copyright holders, which initially went after those individual users, can now then sue the ISPs for not shutting him down and saying, like, hey, look, it's your fault. You let him continue to have access to the internet, and look what he's been doing. Or whether it's more serious, like criminal liability or something like that, that might go on to the ISPs. You got a real problem then, because then the ISPs are, and to date, I think most of the ISPs are pretty reluctant about shutting people down. I mean, there was some talk in the last probably 3 or 4 years about Comcast. Comcast was probably one of the most vocal out of all the ISPs. They started to initiate a policy of traffic filtering or deep packet inspection, whereby they were filtering out certain protocols like BitTorrent protocols and slowing people's internet speeds down when they were shown to be transmitting those protocols back and forth out of their connection. But, you know, there was some talk about them having an internal policy of shutting people down, maybe. But that all that went away, especially when the FCC started to investigate them, and they backed off from it, especially because they got a lot of negative feedback from the public at large, too. Obviously, though, something like this would change the way that ISPs probably look at those individual users who are infringing content. I don't know if you guys know what the statistics are, but because I've heard a lot of different ones out there. But everyone seems to say that there is a large percentage of the traffic that goes back and forth on the internet is, in fact, BitTorrent protocols where people are, at least potentially, or there's a strong likelihood that they're participating in violent infringing on other people's copyrights through file sharing and the like. So even despite that, though, there just hasn't been a lot of reasons for ISPs to shut people down individually.
Yeah, I haven't heard any reliable data as to how much of internet traffic as a whole is BitTorrent. And even then, more and more legitimate operations are using BitTorrent for distribution of media. For example, South by Southwest this year, the reporters were given press packets of songs that were distributed via BitTorrent. So, you know, while a large, substantial, a very large proportion of BitTorrent traffic is illegal or infringing in nature, I don't think it'd be fair to say that all of it was.
So here's an interesting point, though, or a corollary to that. If let's just assume for a minute that the percentage is high. Well, say it's over 25% of traffic that is going back and forth. It relates to a protocol like BitTorrent, which has a strong likelihood of being infringing, even though that seems to be changing as we go into the future. Why then wouldn't the ISPs right now want to shut people down because they're consuming resources through infringing material? Why then wouldn't they want to shut down those individual users? And why would they even, why wouldn't they shut them down, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
I mean, I suppose at the very least, it's another paying customer. And I mean, I think some ISPs are chomping at the bit to start charging people per bit, more or less. And I mean, they would be high traffic users. But other than that, I don't know. Other ideas?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, because that's the only thing that's in my mind is the fact that ISPs in the future were probably more likely to charge on a tiered service level basis, where we talk about bandwidth being in the amount of ultimate data which is processed back and forth out of your connection over a month, let's say. If they move to some sort of tiered service level, where if you pay, you know, $40 a month, then you get 200 gigabytes worth of bandwidth. If you pay $60 a month, that gets up to 300 or 400, so on and so forth. It, under those metrics, then you could see why why they might not want to shut people down, because it's a lot of that ultimate bandwidth that's being transmitted in the BitTorrent protocol or whatever their people are using to share files, their large files. There might be some money to still be made there, and there might be reason not to shut people down.
So swapping to a slightly different topic here, like this is going to be passed potentially as an executive order. Wouldn't that make it subservient to federal law?
That's a tricky question. Not always. If I recall, and this is my best recollection, and maybe Dominic, you could jump in. I think executive orders are generally equal to statutes, unless there's a statute on point that's different, and then the statute takes precedent, and all later statutes overrule executive orders. But executive orders are subservient to the Constitution, while treaties are at the same level as the Constitution. For a quick note for the listeners, executive orders are just signed by the president. Treaties are signed by the president and approved by a 2/3 vote of the Senate.
That's not how I remember it. From what
okay,
I understand,
you go.
The Constitution is the law of the land. It trumps everything. Treaties are on par with federal law, whichever it was enacted most recently controls. So if a treaty is passed, it would override federal law, but if a new federal law is passed, it would override the treaty. Executive orders trump state law always, but if there's federal law on point, the federal law always wins, even if it came before the executive order. So, for example, the healthcare debate, that whole executive order thing, because the law doesn't speak to that particular area of the law, the executive order is the only statement, so it controls.
But an executive agreement and an executive order are two different things. Executive orders are rescindable.
Yes, that is true.
Yeah. An executive order is just something a president signs, and any subsequent president or even the same president can just rescind it. I don't think a president can... I'm not positive. My guess is a president cannot just rescind an executive agreement because they too have greater power.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm sorry, my statement about the controlling was with regard to executive agreements, actually. So, not executive orders.
But the healthcare, that was the
is an executive
was an
order,
executive
yes.
Order.
Not an executive, not executive agreement. Right. So, yes, I said the wrong thing there.
Okay, and
that
you're right. Executive
hold.
Agreements. Executive agreements do prevail over conflicting state law, but never over conflicting federal law or the Constitution.
Correct.
And this week's Constitutional Law Award goes to Ben Snitkoff.
What? I was robbed.
Well, you had your chance. Sorry, you lost. On this note, though, getting back on point here, there was a really interesting piece which was published in the Washington Post this week by Jack Goldsmith and Larry Lessig, who are both law professors out of Harvard, so just over the river from us. And both of them have been pretty outspoken in the past, at least on ACTA concerns. And this particular article, which we'll post in the show notes, does focus on this exact issue about how the U.S. plans to authorize ACTA, should they ever choose to do so, and how it seems that at present they are looking at doing it through this executive agreement route. And the article raises some pretty significant concerns that this might not necessarily be constitutional. In particular, it notes that sole executive agreements are typically used for sort of de minimis types of situations. I think one of the ones they point to was, let's see, when Jimmy Carter was negotiating with Iran, I believe it was, during... back in the 70s when there was the hostage situation over there, small little things, in other words, that are very important, that require quick action, and are not really the types of things that would be subject to public debate. The difference here being that ACTA looks like it's going to be a pretty large and significant agreement that involves many countries, and it could have effects on U.S. law. But if you take this route of going through the executive order, which is just authorized by the president, you have basically taken out the whole public debate part of this. So as citizens, we cannot, you know, we have no input to our local representatives about what's going to happen with this. It could be the case that it just gets approved. And now, so Lessig and Goldsmith here have noted that there's a constitutional concern that whether or not they can even do this. There isn't, the Supreme Court has apparently not spoken on this, about what the actual reach of the law is or the Constitution is in this scenario, and whether or not the president would have control over something like this. But traditionally, under the Constitution, the president does not have control over intellectual property matters, nor over communications matters, so those seem to fall outside the guise of that power. It will be interesting to see what route this does eventually take, and very interesting to see what the final language is actually going to be. Hopefully, out of all of this, what we get is that there's a little bit more transparency in terms of the language that's going to be included in this agreement. One thing that concerns me is that a lot of the major trade groups are very involved in lobbying about for the language that will be included in this agreement, but we haven't heard anything to date about, you know, how is this going to impact us as citizens, as consumers, and users of all those intellectual property rights out there.
Yeah, I would like to chime in and with one, I guess, one last thing. We're a little over time on this story, and that's that the vast majority of ACTA is non-controversial. The vast majority of it merely echoes what current U.S. law is and what current law is in a lot of other places. You know, there seems to be, at least from the documents leaked, a lot of bickering as to what the precise language is, but the vast majority of the treaty is just saying, you know, for certain things there you can get injunctions and you can get certain measures of damages. That's not inconsistent with current U.S. law. But, you know, there are worrisome provisions, and obviously the cloak of secrecy that surrounded this is also very worrisome.
Yeah, and going back to the sort of public debate part of it, I think one interesting factor of this is I think a lot of the, or one of the possible reasons why the trade groups are so interested in this in particular is because the international agreement is subject to a lot less of the public pressure that it would get in the if it was passed on a national level. So, I mean, it's harder to keep account of the people who are in charge of negotiating the U.S.'s terms for this as opposed to members of Congress. Any other final thoughts before we move on?
All set here.
Just one really quick one, and then we can move on. And, you know, this act or this proposed act or treaty or whatever it's eventually going to be, this international agreement between these countries, has received a lot of criticism. But at the same time, you do have to recognize there is this larger issue of intellectual property rights enforcement abroad. And it's very difficult for some of the companies in the U.S. who do own the rights to, you know, intellectual property items to be able to control those problems that happen abroad. And this act, in part at least, is trying or at least attempting to get DMCA-like protection abroad, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I just think that it's worded poorly and there are some problems. It's a little concerning to see these three strikes provisions about cutting off people's internet access. But you still have to be a little bit sympathetic, though, and understand that, you know, all the piracy that goes on is pretty rampant, and there are rights which the companies who produce the material do get, and there should be better ways for them to enforce those rights abroad. This might not be the right way to go about doing it, but you know, it's really hard to take the position that everything that's going on in ACTA is completely wrong, or at least that, you know, what they're trying to accomplish here is wrong. This just might be the example of going about it in the wrong way.
All right, so speaking of another sort of secretive operation, we'll move on to Google in China. And so, as many people know, Google in 2006 started operating Google.cn, a Chinese version of their site, but with a certain level of censorship. So Googling for Tiananmen Square while in China would not result in, you know, controversial images, or at least images that the Chinese government considers controversial. And then as of the beginning of this year, Google says it was going to stop cooperating with Chinese censorship and or start moving out of China altogether based on a number of assaults that they said hackers had been doing to Google and a number of other sites. And so as of this past week, they actually followed through on that operation. They have stopped operating Google.cn, their Chinese domain, and now are redirecting all traffic there to Google.hk, their Hong Kong version of the site. And so since the Hong Kong version does not include the censorship provisions that the Chinese version has, it is essentially a way to work around the Great Firewall. However, China has been running some censorship to block those results as well. Big picture here is that, you know, this is sort of a corporation, you know, involved in at least some amount of foreign policy. Well, they're not controlling anything at the government level. I mean, this is definitely affecting the U.S.'s relationships with China. I don't know. What do you guys think? Is this a good move? Is this going to go anywhere? Or is China just going to move on and keep using their own search engines?
I mean, it's nice that China is not blocking Google entirely, despite the fact that they're redirecting to Hong Kong. And I mean, I think it should be pointed out that Hong Kong is technically part of the People's Republic of China. It's an Wikipedia is telling me it's a special administrative region. The U.S. government policy toward Hong Kong has been to treat it as part of China, complete with, you know, like for instance, we are less likely to grant security clearance to somebody from Hong Kong than we would be from somebody else's country, despite the fact that Hong Kong has its own political setup. What I found most interesting about this story, though, is at some point Google said that the idea to redirect Google.cn to Google.hk, which is Hong Kong's top-level domain, Google said that idea came from China, and in response to that, China said to its press, whatever you do, do not investigate the story, don't push any further, don't ask questions about it, just report what's been out there so far. So if they did give Google that idea, it's kind of strange to say, yes, here's a great way to get around our filtering, and we won't do anything about it. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I have to applaud Google on taking such a positive stance in terms of free speech issues, and such a large country, too, that represses a lot of those free speech issues. And even if those were the supposed results of, hacking, which was then traced to has been traced to the government, the Chinese government, in terms of the origins of where the hacks were initiated from, or at least the schools in China. I don't know if that, how much that really played into Google's overall thought process of, okay, let's try to, open this up and make a difference in China. But something that people always forget is that China, or Google, is not the number one search engine in China. It's Baidu.com or Baidu.cn or whatever the domain is. And Google does not have the same presence in China as it does in the U.S. So while we think of Google as sort of being the Goog or the God almost here in terms of online search, it doesn't have that same type of presence in China. So it's a little unclear to me about how much this is really going to affect policy changes in mainland China, apart from the Hong Kong area. But I'm kind of happy that they did it. This is not a source of major revenue for Google also, so they're able to do this, and they're not really losing a whole lot of their bottom line out of it. There are a lot of other restrictions which are involved from, which the Chinese government imposes on Google just operating as a company in China. So I think all of those put together has made it difficult for Google to really make a lot of money out of the Chinese area in general. And finally, like the biggest thing, which I think you hit on, Ben, which was these media rules, which the Chinese government came out with and issued to all of the major media organizations. And I'm going to read them here because I thought that these were so fascinating and so repressive that it was really sad. But first of all, there's just like 5 points here, and it says, only use central government main media website content. Do not use content from other sources. Do not produce relevant topic pages. Do not set discussion sessions. Do not conduct related investigative reporting. Online programs with experts and scholars on this matter must apply for permission ahead of time. This type of self-initiated program production is strictly forbidden. All websites, please clean up text, images, and sound, and videos which support Google. Dedicate flowers to Google. Ask Google to stay. Cheer for Google and others to have a different tune from government policy. And finally, chief managers in different regions, please assign specific manpower to monitor Google-related information. If there is information about mass incidents, please report it in a timely manner. So what they're doing then is they're basically telling the media outlets how to handle this situation, and they're spinning it so that it's not Google which is pushing away from the Chinese government. It's exactly the opposite. Google is initiating this on its own, but the Chinese government wants them to stay, and they're really flipping the coin on them. So you have to feel pretty sad for the people in China, because not only is free speech restricted in terms of the content that you can search on search engines there, it's also the case that the Chinese government is really spinning this in this sort of Big Brother kind of way. They have like a Ministry of Truth, basically, or straight out of Orwell, and they're controlling what people know about this actual incident. So, in a sense, the Chinese people don't really know what they're missing, and they might never know what they're missing, because they're getting information from media entities, which are completely controlled by the government.
So two quick things. First, on your point that Google's not making a lot of money in China, yes, I think, that since they're not the number one search engine, it's definitely true that they're not making as much money as they could be. But I think that's really the point, in that, China is one of these emerging markets that a lot of corporations really want to sink their teeth into. And so while they might not be making money now, I think they're definitely losing their chance at possibly earning more money and having more profit come from China. And secondly, I think one of the more touching parts of this story has been a lot of these images that we in the United States have seen that people in China are no doubt not seeing, things where people are standing outside Google's headquarters in China, either with candles or just with any number of bouquets on the Google logo covered in snow in China. And, that sort of shows what at least the some Chinese people are thinking about, Google's actions. They really support this, and it makes it all the more tragic that to see the Chinese state's reaction to it, although you can clearly see why. One interesting point here, though, was that there was one comment from a one of the top legal officials at Google saying that they were still within Chinese law. So are any of you more familiar with what laws they actually might be, if they are within the law, and whether or not, since China suggested this to Google, whether or not it's getting around anything in particular, or the actual legal standing of this action?
Sadly, I have not gotten an opportunity to sit for the Chinese bar yet, so I'm not really familiar with Chinese law. But no, I've no idea. I don't think anyone else on the podcast is particularly familiar with Chinese law either. You know, feel free to chime in if you are, though, guys.
Well, judging from my experience in watching 24 and Jack Bauer's Escape from China, never mind.
I'm not very familiar with Chinese law either. But I don't see one of the things that I've been curious about is that Google had to do some sort of internal investigation to determine what the overall impact would be on their bottom line. I mean, sure, Google has presented in the past this image of we're not evil and everything, and we're not necessarily out to make a lot of money, but they are a highly successful company which does make a lot of money, and at least as a public company, and I don't know how much this would actually apply to their actions in China, but they do have a duty to their shareholders to increase the bottom line, and so it had to make sense from a financial standpoint to pull out of China, and I don't know if that was because Chinese law has been so restrictive of the ways in which you can, you know, use advertising on a search engine, and the ways in which Google is able to make money or just monetize their services abroad, and maybe that factored into it. The law was just at the state where they were thinking, well, this is a huge market. There's, you know, 1.5 billion people, or 1.3, whatever the number is, in China. It's a huge market. It's like 5 or 6 times the size of the U.S., but we might never really have a good chance to make a whole lot of revenue out of there. So it's not really hurting our bottom line, and it makes sense to, you know, also from a public policy standpoint, to pull out of the country and, you know, just do other. I think they're still doing other activities in Google. They're just not doing search anymore. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong.
There is this website, which we'll post in the show links, which Google's maintaining, which shows the various status of Google services in China. And so you can sort of see that some of the things are blocked. Some of them are partially blocked. You can go there and check it out. And then moving on to our final story today, it involves Facebook and some intimidation that they're doing of their app, one of the applications there. Or no, it's not an application, excuse me. So a while ago, there was this grease monkey script called Facebook Purity. And for those of you who are not familiar with Grease Monkey, it's an add-on to a number of browsers, mainly Firefox, but also Chrome. There are other tools available for other browsers, which can edit the HTML of websites as you visit them. So if we were to load up the technically legal page, you could have a Grease Monkey plugin that would run on your personal computer, not on our technically legal page, that could modify the HTML somewhere. So it could be to block all of Ben's blog posts, and, you know, it wouldn't be any actual change to the website. It would just monitor the HTML and cut out the bits that Ben wrote. No offense. And so there was this one Grease Monkey script that was used to help clean up Facebook. One of the major complaints about Facebook is the fact that there are other in the news feed, there's often a lot of things that people don't like to see. So some people might get tired of, you know, Farmville updates or other annoying messages that, you know, they don't want to see. So this application was developed, a Grease Monkey script, which just removed certain quiz results and other things of that type. And this became very popular. Then what happened was, first, Facebook hit them with a trademark threat of saying, look, you call this Facebook Purity, you know, we own the Facebook trademark, you can't call it that. So then they changed it to a different name called Fluff Busting Purity, and that was still evocative of the FB, which Facebook is often known by, but different. And then they also had their fan page on Facebook. So this is, I guess, their actual only presence on the Facebook site, which was they had a fan page with over 5,000 people who were declared themselves fans of FB Purity. But then Facebook, for whatever reason, shut down that page. Do you guys still want to go into some of the issues here? Is this something that Facebook can get rid of?
Well, one of the big points here is that GreaseMonkey, which is this wonderful tool that allows you to manipulate the way that web pages are shown to you without, actually having to make any changes from the web server side, it's all about how a web page is perceived by the user. And so, in a way, you're not really affecting anybody else's viewings of the website through a browser, only your own. That presents a particular problem in terms of the law. So if you think about the ways in which a company like Facebook might try to control that, you've got a couple points. You've got the terms of service agreement. They might try to prevent people from using any types of third-party application suites which modify with it, where if they're not previously approved, you could prevent them from modifying the way that web pages are viewed. You could try to take legal action if there are trademark issues, like we saw here, which was the initial threat, was that you're using the company's name, which is a trademark name, it's registered, it's a non-authorized use, or so they claim. There was probably a good claim in there also that that was a case of nominative fair use, a permissible use of a trademark. Although, a kind of a gray argument because it might imply that there's some sort of sponsorship of the GreaseMonkey app. Even after that was changed, though, you might try to take the route, if you were Facebook, to claim that there are some sort of copyright concerns about the way that the GreaseMonkey tool is using and copying or replicating or modifying any of the elements on the page which might fall under the guise of copyright. Now, copyright specifically excludes material which is non. It will exclude anything that's fact-based, non-expressive, or non-original type of material. So that would it could include a number of things like blurbs that either the company has written, patches of text. If and of course, this is all based on the GreaseMonkey actually taking those elements, copying them, and then modifying them in some way before they're shown to the user. And there, you could also say that some of the layout of the site in general, if you're changing that, if the again if the GreaseMonkey tool is then fiddling with some of those things, making copies and making changes to it, you might have an argument that those fall under copyright, and it's another unlawful use of copyright. But all of those things seem to be pretty far-fetched to me because there just doesn't seem to be a ton of stuff just about the overall interface that is really copyrightable on Facebook. And I see them as being the weaker of the two arguments between some sort of contract restriction and going the route of trying to take a lawsuit on copyright issues.
Yeah, I don't really see the copyright claim. It'd be like someone, an author, complaining that, hey, they wrote in the book that I sold them. I don't want people writing in my book because I think my book's so awesome that no one should ever write in it, and how dare they write in it? I just don't see it at all. If I want to script your site on my computer when I'm visiting your site, I should have absolute right to do that, as long as I'm not redistributing it or anything. It's just the way I'm viewing it, whether I'm removing ads,
Yeah.
changing features.
There is that line of cases which is still out there, and I don't know which jurisdictions off the top of my head they fall under, but they take the view that any copies made on the computer, whether or not they fall into just your RAM or the volatile memory on your computer, every time that it passes through there, you're making a copy, so there might be some sort of argument. I haven't looked closely at GreaseMonkey itself or the script itself, and I have no idea about how that's actually interacting with the code itself. And the code is another avenue too, by the way, where you might find enough expression in order for it to be copyrightable. But where you have those interactions between those two things, you've got this, it's a weak argument because I guess it's happening on the individual level. It's not happening on the broad level. It's not being redistributed. It would be interesting to think about if there was some sort of claim to copyright and if a judge was willing to entertain the argument, whether or not that there's some sort of fair use defense. because you're only doing this for personal purposes and changing the layout of the site in front of you. But yeah, I do think it's a weak argument.
And plus, I mean, there is the argument that in some ways this is actually helping Facebook users, you know, avoid, you know, content they don't want. So improving their user experience with Facebook. But I think David, you raised an interesting point, sort of making the analogy to ad blockers. And, you know, ad blockers have a much more direct effect on Facebook or any other site that hosts ads, which basically they can, you know, that will hurt Facebook's revenue. And this one doesn't seem to be hurting their bottom line as much, but it's very possible that that this could be very
You're right. It's plausible, though. You're absolutely right that it's plausible that this might have an effect on the bottom line. If you take just the idea that the way that Facebook is making money, or one of the ways which they make money, is through the sale of advertising. And if you have a tool out there which is publicly available, whether that is Adblocker or whether it's Grease Monkey, which is, you know, taking away some of those elements from the website by which Facebook makes money, there is a financial impact, or at least there could be a financial impact. But, you know, the other side of the coin is that, well, if the people really aren't interested in looking at ads at all, they're probably not likely to click on the ads, which is usually the way that advertisers make money. It's you're measuring the number of clicks per view or clicks per page. There's a bunch of metrics which tie into how the sale of advertising on the internet works. But I don't know. It's always been really interesting to me to think about how something like Adblocker, which effectively blocks most of the ads on the internet. If you combine that with a JavaScript blocker, you can effectively get rid of all the ads that you would see on the internet, and you're just looking at pure pages and pure text. You don't have to worry about those stupid hover things in blog posts where if you suddenly mouse over, you've got like six ads that are in your face. I've always been really interested to think about how companies might try to go after the developers of those little bits of software which do that. But probably the reason why they haven't is because the arguments are so tenuous in terms of the interaction with the underlying code and any type of copyright claim which you might have. I looked at the Facebook Terms of Service today, too, before we started recording, and I didn't really see anything in the Terms of Service which excludes third-party, you know, non-authorized third-party applications manipulating code just for, you know, in a person's browser. Those are probably all the reasons why we haven't seen other lawsuits against companies that are development groups like the Adblock people or Grease Monkey for developing those sets of tools which manipulate advertising and other junky things on the internet.
And those sorts of claims in the terms of service have actually been useful for various online games. So I know World of Warcraft has things in their terms of service against using, you know, different bots or whatever to change the gaming experience. And those also have an effect on the other players as well. I don't know what the actual terms of service say about things that only affect your experience of it, but nevertheless, there seems to be a lot of different avenues that they could take in their terms of service to regulate this sort of thing. All right, Dominic, Ben, any other final thoughts?
I'll chime in and say that the one claim that I thought was the most meritorious that the Facebook could have brought was back when it was called Facebook Purity is some sort of a trademark delusion by tarnishment claim by somehow implying that Facebook isn't pure. But I think there'd be some major difficulties with that lawsuit, largely because you'd have a difficult time proving that anyone thought less of Facebook because they heard that it was unpure as a result of this name. But I mean, that was me at my utmost creative finding a cause of action here.
I'm also willing to bet that it's a pretty small percentage of users, which, you know, considering the overall registrants that are on Facebook, that would use something like Grease Monkey. I mean, I could pull some numbers out of a hat here, but you know what, 1%, 2%, 5% at the very most, it's probably not very high. The technical aptitude with which the average Facebook user has in terms of what they can do on a computer is probably not very much.
One indication is, I don't know what the number is, but Facebook has however many million of users, and this page, which was shut down, only had 5,000 fans. Not that that says how many people actually use it, but at the very least, it was at least 5,000. And that's one other issue we didn't talk about is whether or not it was legal for Facebook to shut down this fan page, but that could wait for another time.
Oh, well, that we could hit that really quick here because I can almost guarantee you within those terms of service, Facebook retains all the rights to shut down individual pages. I mean, they do, you know, the language is pretty clear that they retain a lot of power in terms of who can register and who can set up pages. I mean, we're not talking about public rights here. You know, there's no affirmative rights under the law that to make a Facebook page or anything like that. You might have some sort of ancillary. Well, actually, no, you wouldn't even have. I'll just stop that right there. To prevent myself from sounding stupid, but there's not a lot that you can do if they shut down a page individually. In other words, unless there's some sort of affirmative contract right which they've afforded to you in the terms of service or by some other means, you know, between yourself and Facebook.
All right, and with that, I think we'll wrap up for the week. Thanks for listening. As usual, you can check us out at technicallylegal.org, on Twitter at TechLegal. We don't quite have a fan page yet, but if there's enough demand, we will make one.
We have
And
no plans for a Facebook fan page. They would take it down. So they'd be like, this is too
and
awesome for Facebook.
exactly right. And that's why I'm David Liu.
I'm Dominic Gravier.
I'm Ben Snick.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thank you. Have a good week.
Hi, and welcome to Podcast 43. My name is David Liu, and this is Podcast. Ah, shit.
You said that already.
Yay, David Liu pulled a Ben Snitcop.